You know, when I'm at home, I like to go for a walk in the morning, get out first thing, just go for a hard walk and get juices flowing. And it's great in the morning, and sun's coming up, birds are singing. And, you know, I was thinking just this last week, I was out on a walk and I just had this thought. I thought, you know, I think one of the reasons why God created mornings was so that every day you could be reminded that He is the author of new beginnings. Every day is a new beginning. And you know, I've had to take comfort in that, because there have been days I just wanted the day to end. This is a bad day. It's been a bad week. But you know, the next morning the sun comes up, there's a freshness, there's a whole new day lying before you, and with God, anything is possible. How long does it take Almighty God to do an amazing work in a life? It takes but a moment. And so every time I see the sun come up, I'm just kind of reminded that what happened yesterday is yesterday. And God is always the God of today. He's always the God of today. I've seen men beating themselves up for years about what happened in the past. And that's not where His focus is. His focus is always today, because it's what He could do in your life today that matters, not how you messed up yesterday. And so I hope even as you enter this day today to think, what is the potential? I mean, what could God do? If God just looked at my life and said, in this day today, I'm going to do an awesome thing, what are the possibilities? Just expect Him to do that. And when you see the sun coming up, some of you may have this aching feeling like, oh no, it's another day. But I always like to think in terms of, and what might God do today? Before the sun sets today, what could He do in my life if I was just completely surrendered to Him? Well, I want to share with you a journey I had several years ago. Speaking of early mornings, I was in Canada at the time, in Calgary, and I was going to fly down. Ultimately, I was going to Mississippi, I guess, and I was taking kind of a circuitous route to get there. I had an early morning flight down to Denver, and then I was flying over to Houston, and then I was going down to Jackson. It was kind of a long day of connections and travel and airports, and some of you know what that's like. And so I got up early. It was about 3:30, I think, in the morning, and I had to commute to the airport, get started, and get to Denver. And I'm weary. I find, okay, here's my gate. I'm kind of standing around the gate. And all of a sudden, there's a crackle on the intercom system, and a voice comes on and says, folks, if you're on this flight to Houston, we're so terribly sorry, but we've had some mechanical difficulty with this particular airplane, and so we're going to have to, but don't worry, we're going to move you to a different plane, but it's in a different gate. The gate was way, way down the other end of the terminal, and so everybody's got to get up, and we're glad they've got a plane, but it means we all got to cart all of our stuff down to the other end of the airport. So we're all making our way down there. We get there, and we're sitting around. People, it's a smaller gate area, and there's people who had a seat before don't have a seat now, and they're a little bit grumpy. And you know, it's always fun to hear people, you know, parents with young kids, and they're so grumpy, you know, and they're nattering at their kids, and you realize they're taking their kids on a family vacation, you know, but it's like, well, you sit still, stop touching your sister, and you think, wow, that is going to be an awesome family vacation they're in for, I tell you. They already hate each other, they haven't even gotten to where they're sitting yet, but, and there's a couple, I heard one couple, you know, bickering, you know, the husband saying, well, honey, didn't you pack this? Well, no, you told me I was to do this. Well, I thought you would get that because I was busy getting the car loaded. And they're like, you mean we don't have that? And you just hear all this stuff and you think, I'm going to go 30-some thousand feet in the air and in a confined space with these grumpy people. Like, this is going to be a great time. And so we're there for a while. And then the intercom comes on again. And they said, folks, I'm really sorry about this. We've had another issue that had come up. And they're actually going to have to move us. I think the plane, they had some kind of issue. Anyway, we've got to move again. And now at this point, people are sort of pushed over the edge. And now they're really grumbling and not make it pretty obvious they're unhappy about this. They're packing up their stuff again, grabbing their kids. I never had this before, where we're moved to two different gates just in one flight. We're moved down the hall to another place. This place, there's nowhere to sit. I'm just leaning against a wall, not even trying to find a seat. I don't necessarily want to sit in amongst these people anyway until I have to. And so I'm just sitting there. And at this point, you can just feel like it's a powder keg, like just one more piece of bad news. Somebody's going to just go over the edge, you know. And so we're all kind of sitting there and muttering and bickering. And all of a sudden, the crackle of the alarm, the intercom comes on again, and everybody just is silent. We've already been moved twice, and now they're about to make an announcement, and it's not sounding necessarily good, so everybody's listening. Only this time, the announcement is not for the public at large. This time, it's for me. And a voice on the intercom, so that everybody in that side of the airport can hear, says, "Would a Richard Black baby come to the ticket?" Now, my name, Blackabee, is an English name. If you can speak English, it shouldn't be that difficult just to read the name before broadcasting it to the entire airport. And so I walk up and I say, did you call for a Richard Blackabee? I said, and she kind of looked at me, and everybody's looking to see Richard Blackabee and see what he looks like. And they said, well, can I see your boarding pass? I thought they were going to challenge me on the pronunciation of my last name. So I slide over there, clearly as Blackabee. They take my boarding pass, and she rips it in two. And she says, "We need your seat." I thought things couldn't get any worse, but apparently they can. And well, I'm just like, I'm just in shock. I'm just staring at this woman like, what on earth do I say to that? She slides over another boarding pass and says, "I'm afraid we're going to have to move you up into business class." Well, all of a sudden, I could have sworn I heard birds singing. It's like the sun began to shine. I said, "That's Richard Black, baby, at your service." And then, "God bless you, one and all." I said, because all of a sudden, things are great. And a moment later, they board business class, so I scurry on board. I've got this nice leather seat. This wonderful flight attendant, just right away, he just descends upon me, and he said, "What can I get you?" And this is back when you still got service and things like that, even in business class. And, do you like a coffee? Do you like this? I mean, we had not even taxied out to the runway, and I've already had a coffee, a Diet Coke, and a bottle of water. It's like, what else can you bring me? It's like, let's just knock it back. Well, then after I'm all settled in, having my coffee and my bottle of water, then the riffraff starts boarding the plane, you know. It's like all those grumpy people and those kids, like, "Mom, are we sitting here?" "No, keep going. We're at the back. Just keep going," you know. And I felt it was rather awkward. I would watch these people all pass me as I'm eating all this stuff. And I wanted them, you know, back behind the veil, the little curtain that they pull. But the interesting thing, so we take off, and then this is when they served you food in business class. Now you don't get that much, but then you actually got a meal. And so they came up to me and they said, "Sir, we have three choices today for your meal. There's like a beef tenderloin, there's a fish, and then there's some kind of salad thing. And what would you like?" And I knew what my options were going to be back, you know, in the back. It was going to be like dry stale peanuts or nothing, you know. Now I've got like actually meals. This is wonderful. But what was interesting was that right after I had been upgraded, they upgraded someone else, and they called a woman's name. I don't know if they butchered her last name, but they called her up, and they went through the same routine, a sadistic sort of thing. I saw them rip her boarding pass up and then give her an upgrade. And so I know that this other woman and I are both kind of upgraded, you know. We sort of turned out to be a little more pleasant, we thought. So I'm watching her to see if she's enjoying the ride as much as I am. But she's not. This guy comes up to her. She's sitting across the aisle from me, and he says, "Ma'am, what can I get you? Would you like some coffee this morning?" "Well, what kind is it?" He said, "Well, yeah, it's Starbucks." She said, "Oh, I can't stand Starbucks coffee. Do you have anything else?" "Well, no, that's all we have. But would you like tea? I can make you tea." "Well, what kind of tea do you have?" He mentions a couple. She didn't like any of those. So by the time it gets to lunch, I'm I'm thinking, you know, I wonder how this woman's going to handle this. And so the flight attendant comes up, and he's just been a real good sport about it. He keeps trying to find something that will please her. And so she chooses the fish. And now just a, I mean, just a general policy with me, if you're having a bad day, don't order fish. Because there's just too much that can go wrong with fish. But she does, and I think that's a bad job. I can just see a disaster approaching. And so sure enough, he lays it down. And back then, again, like they had actual nice tray, real dishes and glass and everything. And she takes one bite. I'm spying on her at this point. She takes one bite of the fish, and she literally spews it out of her mouth. Just spits it out. And calls the guy back and says, "This is terrible! Like, what is this? What kind of fish is this? Like, I can't eat this." And the guy spent the rest of the flight trying to please this woman. And now at a certain point, I wanted to say something to this woman. I wanted to say, "Look, I happen to know that you did not pay to be up here. You should be back with the riffraff back there behind the veil, where they just walk by and fling water at you as they go by. Like, and you've got this awesome flight attendant who's just going overboard trying to help you out, and like, you're the most miserable person I've ever met." But of course, I didn't say anything because I didn't want her to attack me. I mean, the guy, flight attendants pay to deal with grumpy people like that. So I didn't say anything, but I thought to myself I was leaving. The interesting thing was I'd actually had a publisher ask me about writing a book with them, and I was trying to think what would I want to write about, and that sort of started me on a journey. Because I realized that, you know, as a Christian, you have been radically upgraded as well, have you not? I mean, you had one destination that your life was headed toward, and your destination was radically upgraded. You were going through life on your own, with your own wisdom and strength, trying to figure out life. And now you've got a Holy Spirit who's constantly asking you, "What else can I do for you? What resource of heaven can I bring to bear in your life?" And yet, have you ever known a grumpy Christian? You ever known a miserable, negative, dissatisfied Christian? A self-centered Christian? Critical Christian? It began a journey. I began to realize, you know what, the church is filled with people who've had this amazing upgrade that was totally undeserved, not paid for, and yet we're not satisfied. In fact, some of us are just downright miserable. And God began to put me next to a number of miserable Christians who'd been a follower of Jesus for years, and yet nobody even wanted to be around them. And I ultimately wrote a book called Putting a Face on Grace. Because I realized the problem with a lot of Christians is they've never really understood what happened to them when they were upgraded, when they were made a child of the King. And I want you to look at probably one of the best known stories in this regard. It's found in Matthew chapter 18. I want to just walk you through the story for a moment and then just share with you how God has applied this in my life. Matthew 18, beginning verse 21, it says, "Then Peter came to him and said," and by the way, you know, often Peter is known for jumping out with the answers, but this time Peter, he starts off by asking a question. He says, "So how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to 7 times. And you have to realize what Peter's asking is this: where's the line? Like, where's the line? Like, I know that as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus, you can't just never forgive. I know you can't just be real harsh with people all the time. But I mean, at a certain point, when people continually hurt you, when they continually disappoint you, like, at a certain point, you can't be a doormat, right? Like, at a certain point, it's enough, right? When is enough enough? And in the Middle Eastern culture, of course, usually it was zero. If I hurt you, boy, you came back and you slammed me. So I never thought about doing that again. That's why there's so much violence and generations of hatred today, because there was no grace whatsoever. But the Jewish religious leaders of that time, they realized, well, you can't have a society where there's no tolerance, where there's no forgiveness, there's no grace. I mean, no society can survive. You just be in constant warfare if you don't have some grace. So they decided that a reasonable amount of grace was 3 times. So if I offend you, you've got to forgive me the first time. If I offend you a second time, you've got to forgive me. If I offend you a third time, by this time you're gritting your teeth and you're clenching your fists, but you got to forgive me a third time. But if I'm stupid enough to go back and do it a fourth time, they said, hey, I mean, go ahead, let him have it. Like, any guy's going to push you four times when you've forgiven him three times? Like, that's where the line is. And so what Peter was asking is, Jesus, okay, so where do you say the line is? I mean, my wife has disappointed me. My husband has cheated on me. My father was abusive to me. I mean, there's all kinds of hurts. I mean, are there certain kinds of hurts that are so bad that you can say there's no grace left for you? I mean, just Jesus, you tell me where the line is where you don't have to forgive anymore. And Peter actually offers the answer. He says, is it seven times? Now, the Jewish leader said three times. So what's Peter doing? He's going over double the going rate. Like he's trying to impress Jesus with the right answer. I'm going over twice as much as anybody else says. And he's expecting another, well done, you know, good and faithful Peter. You always have the right answer. But, of course, what does Jesus say? He said, Jesus said to him, I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. And, of course, he's not talking about 490. What does he say? What he's saying is, Peter, there is no line. There is no limit. There's no point, there's no kind of hurt, there's no offense that you can point to and say, well, if you do that, there's no more grace for you. There's no more forgiveness. Jesus said, if you're going to follow me, there can't be a line. There can't be a point where you say, enough's enough. You pushed me too far this time. That's pretty radical for that day, isn't it? And then, as Jesus often did, he tells a story. And he says, therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he began to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Now, by the way, right through the whole Bible, there is always the message of accountability, isn't it? Back to Matthew and another place, it says, be careful what you say because you're going to be held accountable for every little word that you spoke. The Bible says, listen, man, you will be held accountable for what you do. And in this case, the king starts auditing the books. He starts looking at each servant of his. And when he gets to one particular servant, he discovers that this man owes him 10,000 talents. Now, that doesn't mean a lot to us now, but in this day, if you, a normal working man, if you went out and worked hard all day, you would earn one denarius. Well, a talent was a measure of weight, and so it kind of depended on what money was, gold was worth at the time. But a talent could be worth up to 6,000 denarii. So what one talent is 6,000 days' wages, and he owes 10,000 talents. Some of you who are good at math, what is 6,000 times 10,000?
More than a lifetime.
More than a lifetime. It's about 60 million. 60 million days' wages. Now, how does a servant just happen to owe 60 million days' wages? Not by getting an advance on the occasional paycheck. This guy has completely messed up. He's obviously, it's criminal. It is, or incredibly incompetent. Either way, it's a time of accountability. The point is, it's an astronomical, impossible debt to repay. If you live 60 million more days, you can't earn that kind of money back. So it's impossible. It's way beyond what any human being could ever pay. How he could get into such debt is unbelievable. But the whole point is, it's absolutely impossible to repay. And so it says, as he was not able to pay, which is obvious, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and that payment be made. And so what the king is saying is, all right, go to his house, grab his wife, put her on the slave block, sell her for what you can get. Go to those kids' school, drag the kids out of the classroom, put them on the slave block, sell them for whatever you can get. Sell his house, go in and get every possession he has. Sell it all, and it won't even begin to just scratch the surface of what this guy owes me. And then sell that man himself so that the rest of his life he's nothing but a lowly slave. And you know, the whole point of this story is, and that the king was being perfectly just. And the guy doesn't even argue the case. The guy doesn't even say that's not fair, because the servant knows full well it is fair. That is the law. That is what he deserves. So in verse 26, it says, the servant, therefore, fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. Of course, how is he going to do that? He owes an astronomical amount. It's impossible to ever get that money back. And the implication is he squandered it, it's gone, he can't just go to a nest egg and return it. It's impossible to pay it back. Now, the king and this man both know, it's just talk, he's just delaying. There's no, he can't pay it back, it's impossible. But then, I think one of the greatest verses in the New Testament, verse 25, it says, then the master of that servant was moved with compassion. Now, how do you have compassion for a guy who's just robbed you blind? How do you have compassion on a jerk who was entrusted with the care of your goods and he spent it so fast that it was like water flowing through his fingers? He just blew away all your stuff with total disregard. How do you care about someone like that? I think for most of us, if we saw a guy who'd robbed us of everything we had on the floor begging us to have mercy on him, we'd say, well, good for you. You're going to get exactly what you deserve. I don't feel any compassion at all. But you know what? The reason you and I are children of the King today is because there was a moment when he looked at every sinful thing we'd done in our life and he had compassion. After all the years of rebellion and self-centeredness and the disrespect and dishonor of God that we had committed against Him. Still, when God looked at us, His heart was moved with compassion. Aren't you grateful that our King has compassion when He looks at us? And He doesn't just snicker at us and say, good, you get exactly what you deserve. And it says He forgave him the debt. Now, He doesn't have to forgive the debt. He could have at least said, okay, well, you're going to work this off, right? I know you can't pay it all off, but at least you're going to be putting in a lot of overtime. You're going to be working off. I'm going to keep track. There'll be a little ledger on my refrigerator that keeps track of every denarius that you have to pay off. And at least you'll be reminded every day of just how much you owe me. I mean, that would have been fair. They say, at least you're going to have to put in double shifts the rest of your life. You have no vacation, no days off. At least I've got you right where I want you. I'll just squeeze every ounce of work out of you I can. But what does the king do? He says, it's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. Which, by the way, some of you need to be reminded about that in the sin of your past. Because when God looks at you with compassion, He doesn't say, okay, I'll let you be one of my children, but you're going to have to live in guilt the rest of your life. I'll regularly remind you what a jerk you were in the past, but yeah, you can be one of my children. When God forgives, what does He do? The debt's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. It's not there anymore. That's how God forgives. And now let me ask you, if you owed 60 million days' wages, and the person that you were indebted to said, look, just forget it. It's done. You don't owe a dime. You are debt-free as of right now. How would you spend the rest of that day? What would you do? Would you not throw a party? Would you not be calling all your friends? Would that not be the best day of your entire life? Would you ever get over that day? I mean, years later, when someone mentioned the day that you were set free, could you wipe the grin off your face? Would you not be the most generous person on the planet after you've just been forgiven an astronomical debt yourself? Of course, what does it say? Verse 28. But that servant went out and found. I mean, it doesn't say he happened to pass by. It says he went looking for someone, another fellow servant who owed him 100 denarii. That's about 3 months' wages. 3 months' wages owed to him. He's just been forgiven 60 million years' wages. And it says he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, pay me what you owe. Now let me ask you, how could a person be that calloused towards someone who owed him after just what he'd been forgiven himself? Is that even possible? Could a human being be that ignorant? That stupid? To be just forgiven a debt that was astronomical and not even be able to get home without already being angry at someone who owed him a small fraction of what he'd just been forgiven. It says, so that his fellow servant fell down at his feet and begged him, saying, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. you notice he uses the exact same words the first guy used. He makes the exact same request, just to have pay, and he could repay 3 months' wage. That was possible. If he just had patience, he could get paid back the 100 denarii that he was owed. But this time you don't hear about any compassion. Instead, he says, and he would not. By the way, would not means that forgiveness is always a choice, isn't it? It doesn't say he could not. It says he just chose not to forgive. Forgiveness is always a choice. But he went and threw him into prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw what had been done, they were very grieved and came and told their master all that had been done. Then his master, after he called him, said to him, "You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Should you not also have had compassion on your fellow servant, just as I had pity on you?" And his master was angry. By the way, you know, parables, you have to be careful because there's never just a direct line. You can't take every point and say, okay, so this is what God does. But you know, you get the sense that after God has forgiven you, what do you think God thinks when you turn around and refuse to forgive someone else? Do you think that God is not in the same way marvel that after all that he's forgiven you, you could be so callous as to be unwilling to forgive someone who owes you so much less than what you owed to God? It said it made the king angry. He couldn't believe it. And he said he delivered him to the torturers until he should pay all that was due him, which in other words means he's there the rest of his life. So, my heavenly Father, by the way, when you see the word so, it's always, when Jesus said so, it's always good to pay attention. He says, so, my heavenly Father also will do to you if each of you from his heart does not forgive his brother his trespasses. I call this the paradox of graceless Christians. How could it, see, to become a Christian, you have to have had a moment in your life where the King of Kings looked at all the indebtedness, all the sin of your life, and said, you're forgiven. You have to have been forgiven to be a child of the King. But then to turn around as a Christian and see someone who's hurt you, who's offended you, and to say, but I will not forgive you. I call it the paradox of graceless Christians. By the way, for years when I read this parable, and I was trying to identify with one of the characters, do you know who I always identified with? The guy who owed 100 denarii. Because, I mean, I became a Christian when I was 7 years old. My dad was a minister. Every Sunday of my life, I was in church. I mean, how much can a seven-year-old, how many offenses toward God can you commit? Well, I knew I was a sinner. But I always sort of pictured that somewhere in heaven, you know, Gabriel would call out and say, hey, we need a little bit of grace here. We got to forgive a seven-year-old. I mean, he stole a cookie once, you know, he was unkind to his little brother once. I mean, how much grace does it require to forgive a seven-year-old? Just take, we just need a little thimbleful, just a little tiny little drop or two ought to be sufficient for him. I never identified with the guy who owed 10,000 talents. Till one day God just said, no, you're mistaken on that one, Richard. You didn't owe just 100 denarii. And God said to me, Richard, would you like to be in heaven one day with all the saints of heaven gathered around the throne? Then Gabriel to get up and say, all right, Richard's here with us, and we just thought as he's entering into heaven, we'd take a moment just to list all the sins that Richard has ever committed in his lifetime. We'll just start at the beginning, every sin he committed, every evil thought that he ever thought, everything he knew that he should do that he did not do, every unkind word. And Gabriel would say, you might want to all sit down. This is going to take a while. And then just begin to list sin after sin after sin over a lifetime. God just said to me, Richard, you owed a lot more than 100 denarii. Don't ever fool yourself. Everyone in this room owed $10,000. We all were hopelessly in debt. So we got to start there and say that was us. And so the question is, so how do you deal with other people who sin against you? And I was doing this is what happens a lot of times. What I realize is this. When it comes to grace, one of the reasons I wrote this book, Putting a Face on Grace, is because I've grown up in church all my life. And when Christians talk about grace, most of the time, we're talking about receiving grace. Amazing Grace, probably the most popular Christian song of all time. It's all about what grace does for us. And so it's like, as a Christian, you go before God and you say, God, thank you for your grace. It's so amazing. I mean, every time I need you to forgive me, you're always there. If I sin 1,000 times in a day, you forgive me 1,000 times. And then we come out and we find out our wife forgot to pick up the dry cleaning that she said she was going to pick up. And now we don't have our shirt we need for the next day. And we say, honey, how could you forget that? I told you I needed that shirt. You just can't forget stuff like that. I can never trust you with things when I really need it. And then we go back and say, oh, God, thank you. I mean, when I mess up, you're just there. You don't condemn me. You don't ever judge me for it. You just freely give me your grace. And then we come home from work and we find our son didn't mow the lawn like he was supposed to. And we just get all over him and say, son, you're never going to get a decent job if you can't even be responsible enough to mow a lawn. What's wrong with you? And we go back and it's like our arms are open wide. Oh, God, just shower the grace upon me. Your grace is so amazing. And then we turn around and deal with the people in our lives and we become grace tightwads. You know, it's like when we're receiving it, it's like, oh, how amazing, and just love to bask in the grace of God. Then it comes to dispensing it, and all of a sudden it's like, well, I don't know if he deserves grace. I don't know if he's done enough to qualify. I gave him grace last year, and he, look at what he's done with it. The paradox of graceless Christians. When it comes to receiving, we're fairly, you know, generous in what we expect. When it comes to giving, all of a sudden it's, well, do they deserve this or not? What have I already done for them? I was doing a men's conference like this in another part of the country a number of years ago now, and the guy that was in charge of it, this theme was on holiness, and this guy was big into holiness, men being living lives of integrity, and the whole theme was about, you know, and he had pornography, like internet filters that he was getting all the men to put on and to protect themselves and keep pure, and it was a, you know, that is really his focus, which was a great focus, but he was so busy monitoring everything in the conference that I'd hardly had a chance to speak to him. But he was driving me back to the airport the last day, and it was a bit of a drive. And so as we're driving, I thought, well, you know, I really don't know much about this guy. What's going on with him? So I asked him, well, tell me how you're doing. What's going on in your life? And he said, well, this last year has been the worst year of my life. I said, really? Why is that? This guy had started a software company a couple years earlier, and he had a brother-in-law, his wife's husband, who had been unemployed, couldn't get work anywhere. And so his brother-in-law is not a believer. And so the men's leader, the guy who started the company, he thinks, you know, this would be great. I need someone to do sales for me. I can give a job to my brother-in-law, and he can live where we do. Maybe he'll start going to our church. Maybe he'll become a Christian. And I'll get my brother-in-law saved. I'll provide him work at the same time. It's a win-win situation. So he hires his brother-in-law. Now, his brother-in-law's been without work for a while, and he really wants to do a good job. And his brother-in-law is the boss, so he really wants to please him. But the guy's not the best salesman in the world, and he's not making any sales. So one day he comes back to the office, the boss says, hey, how'd it go today? Do you have any success today? And he finds himself telling a little white lie. He talks like he's just made a sale. And the boss is, oh, he's just praising him, and that's wonderful, that's great. And a day or so later, he kind of lies about another sale. He starts talking about sales that don't exist. But the boss starts assuming that these are real orders, and he starts placing orders for materials and supplies to meet all these orders. And finally, one day, it all becomes clear. It's all been a fabrication. It's all been a falsehood. The salesman, brother-in-law, just wanted so desperately to please the boss, his brother-in-law, that he's lied. The problem is now that the boss has put all these orders in that he can't get out of. He's got all these expenses coming in. He's got no revenue from sales coming in. The man said, I almost went bankrupt. He said, I fired my brother-in-law. He said, that was a year ago. He said, I haven't spoken to him since. He said, it's alienated me from my sister, my parents, the rest of our siblings. They're all taking sides. It's just decimated the family. He said, it's been the worst year of my life. So we're driving along, and I didn't want to upset him too much because we were driving on a major freeway at that point. But I said, well, let me ask you. I said, what was it like forgiving your brother-in-law? And there's this painful silence. And then he said, oh, forgiving him is going to be a long, slow, painful process. Now, it had been a year already, and he hadn't spoken to him. So, silence again. I said, tell me something. Is that how God forgave you? When God looked at all your sin, all your rebellion, all the dark, ugly stuff in your life, did he look at your life and say, oh, wait a minute, you don't think I can just forgive you like that, do you? Oh no, forgiving you is going to be a long, slow, painful process. He just said, no, he forgave me just like that. I said, then why wouldn't you forgive your brother-in-law the same way? But you see, that's what it's like. When it comes to being forgiven, we assume God forgives, forgets, moves on. But well, I'll tell you what, it takes us sometimes years, and we still haven't forgiven. How could you be forgiven so much and be unwilling to forgive so little? That's the paradox. You see, what I've discovered is this. You show me a man who's having trouble forgiving somebody, and I'll show you a man who has never grasped the truth that the king forgave him 10,000 talents. You just can't. You see, what happens is, as Christians, we somehow forget. We somehow lose the wonder of the fact. We forget about that moment when the king looked at all the ugliness of our life and said, it's forgiven. You don't owe us thing anymore. And you think, how could you ever get over that? You think if you lived to be 100 years old, you'd still be grinning at what God did for you that day. But we get over God's grace. We forget. We lose the wonder of it. And it's easy to tell someone who's lost the wonder of God's grace, all you got to do is look and see how they treat other people. Let me ask you this. What is grace? What is grace? It's kind of hard to describe. No, we know it's an undeserved gift. So, you know, when people say, well, can you forgive someone that hasn't said they're sorry? I've had people ask that. Well, yeah, because, you know, grace is undeserved. Grace is not based on what other people do. Grace is what you do. You focus on what is it you give. It's not based on, well, they have to do this first. They don't seem sorry enough. They're not taking responsibility yet. They haven't shown remorse over how they hurt me yet. Well, that doesn't matter, because if they did, your grace wouldn't be grace anymore, because grace is undeserved. It's a gift. But you know, the thing about grace is, grace, it forgives. Grace, it blesses. Grace lifts people up. You can always tell when someone's received grace because they're built up. You can tell people who haven't received grace because they're torn down. In fact, one way to describe grace is, grace makes people like Jesus. When you show them grace, it just showers them with Jesus. And so I've had to ask myself, you know, I've been a Christian since I was 7, which means I've been a Christian a long time. And you'd think that instead of grace wearing off, the longer that you experience daily, God giving me what I don't deserve, I'd be even more enthralled with it than I was the day that God said, you're forgiven. Because every day, God has to give me a fresh measure of grace. He's got to forgive me for all the latest. Every day, I can't get through one day without God having to give me more grace. For all these years, every day, I've been given the grace of God. And so you'd think I'd be just looking for places to give undeserved gifts to other people. You'd just think I'd be just looking for ways to just bless people with my words. But you know, that's oftentimes not what I do. And so let me just share just a couple of areas, especially for a moment, that as men in particular, I think we ought to be the biggest grace givers in the area. And the first one, of course, is in our marriage. You know, when you get married, you've got two. You dress up pretty nice on your wedding day, but you basically have two pretty self-centered, sinful, fallen people now uniting together, choosing to live together. By the way, how many of you are married to someone who is opposite to you? How many opposites are okay? I am too. I mean, my wife and I, on any chart, any personality graph, we are like, you could not possibly be farther away than I. We are like opposite on every solitary possible way to measure. Any kind of test, we're all the different letters, different whatever it is, And so, but somehow, you know, you get married, and those opposites can either create an enormous synergy and an amazing marriage, or it can cause an awful lot of heartache, and a lot of long nights talking, staying up late at night. We got married. We started dating in the early '80s, I guess. And my daughter, who's a very fashion conscious princess, saw a picture the other day of me, what I looked like back then. I was in high school in the '70s. I had these bell bottom pants. Any of you guys, were you in the age where you wore bell bottom pants? These were corduroy bell bottom pants. They swish. You couldn't walk along without swishing the bell striking each other. I had these ratty t-shirts. I had this corduroy jacket. I mean, it was hideous. It didn't match corduroy pants at all, and I had like basically an afro haircut. And so, it was interesting the day that I proposed to Lisa. We had a party at my house where I lived at the time, not long afterward, and all of a sudden Lisa's not there anymore. I got word maybe I offended her, said something wrong. I'm looking for her, I can't find her anywhere. Finally, I go down in the basement where my room was, and I hear this noise, and I open it up, and there's Lisa. She's got this big garbage bag. She's pulled out all my dresser drawers, and she's like, you know, my favorite gym socks I'd worn in 1,000 basketball games, and these shorts and t-shirts I'd had through all kinds of battles and sports over the years. She's just putting them all in the garbage. I said, Lisa, what are you doing? She said, well, now that you're marrying me, like, some things are going to have to change around here. I said, well, aren't you marrying me for who I am? I said, no. She said, I'm marrying you for who I'm going to make you become, she said. But anyway, my daughter saw a picture of me when I was in my prime back then. This is like a year or so ago. She sees this picture of me at that point in our lives, and she looked at my wife and said, Mom, what were you thinking? I mean, like, you mean Dad looked like that? And you said yes? She said, I mean, surely, Mom, I've seen pictures of you when you were younger. You weren't that desperate. Surely you had other options. But you look back and you realize when you start out, like, you've got two very imperfect people who've got a lot of work to do. The problem is that for a lot of us, see, if you're driven by grace, if you're constantly looking at the other person and saying, and how can I help that person along the journey? That's really what my wife has done for years. She found me in a pretty scruffy part of my life, and she spent the last 31 years helping me to become what God always intended for me. When my dad got engaged to my mother, apparently he sat my mother down and said, now if you're going to marry me, he said, I want to know something. I want you to tell me every promise you've ever made to God. When you were at a youth camp, children's camp, prayer time, and a revival meeting, you tell me everything you ever told God that you were going to do. And he said, I want to make a list of those, and I'm going to spend the rest of my life helping you keep all your promises to God. That's what merit. That's what grace is, isn't it? It's saying none of us is there yet. We're two people on a journey, but we've committed to walk with each other and help each other till the day we get there. I speak at the Billy Graham Cove usually a couple times every year in Asheville, North Carolina, and I was there one time and I saw this couple. They were sitting in the front row. And you know, sometimes you look and there's just a couple that's just clearly in love. You know, like they're always touching. And they were like, they were older. They weren't just newlyweds. Clearly, they're middle-aged people. They're holding hands, got their arm around each other. They're looking, smiling at each other. And so after the service, they both came up to me, both just glowing. And they said, Richard, we got to tell you our story. They said, when we got married, we were two very selfish people. It was all about, what are you doing for me? I don't deserve to be treated like that. I've done all this. Why aren't you coming in and doing what you should do? All the focus was on how the other was falling short. And there was just a record. If my wife ever said anything unkind to me, I immediately pulled out my list of every little shortcoming my wife had ever done and all the unkind things she said in the past. And we could go nuclear in no time. You cross that line and boy, I'm going to fire right back. And she said it was just a very volatile relationship. But we were raising kids and our kids kept us together. But finally, when our kids were teenagers, they said we just couldn't take it anymore. Just two selfish people with a long list of grievances. And it just wasn't working anymore, and so we ended up getting divorced. And they said, we went our separate ways. They still lived in the same city, but they went to different, they still went to church. They were Christians, churchgoers. But they went to different churches. And about 3 years later, in September, in both churches, the churches decided to go through experiencing God. And so the husband, the wife, they both enroll in this class. They don't know the other is doing it, but they both start into this class. And the more they looked at Jesus, and the more they looked at the grace that God had given them, the more disgusted they became with the way they'd been living their life. And they began to reflect all the unkind things they'd said, all the demands, all the little guilt trips, all the little innuendos, all the little side comments. And they said, the more that we began looking at Jesus and what he'd done for us, the more it broke our hearts to realize we could have made that marriage work. We were just far too self-centered instead of God-centered. And so I don't know which one took the initiative, but both of them are going through this journey at the same time, don't know the other one is. One of them emails the other one and says, hey, listen, could we do lunch one day, maybe next week? I think maybe the husband reached out and he said, listen, don't worry, like, won't be any fighting. I promise you, won't be ugly. I just have some things I really need to just put on the table for you. But listen, I promise you, it won't be another argument. So the wife thinks, yeah, this is great because I've got things I want to say to you. So they get together. Both of them are like stumbling over being the first one to say, it was my fault. If I'd been Christ-centered, if I'd had the grace of God like I should have had, we'd be married to this day. Well, they both just start crying and weeping and saying, we were just so blind. After all that God had done, how could I get so uptight about stuff that didn't even really matter? And they're just weeping there at the lunch counter together. Finally, after a series of meetings, they get in this crazy idea, well, why don't we get married again? Why don't we do it again? Neither of them has remarried. And interestingly, their teenage kids were the ones who begged them not to get remarried. They said, Mom, Dad, I mean, it's great. You guys are kind of reconciled. But, like, we can't go through that again. Like, you know, if this doesn't last, like, we just don't want to see you guys break up again. Like, that was just once is enough in a lifetime for what we experienced. But they said, we're going for it. Because now we get it. What God wants to make available to us. How can two people willing to just keep showering grace on the other, how can that not work? And so they got married. They'd been married about 4 years when I said, 4 years later, I mean, literally in an auditorium of about 500 people, you could pick them out as the happiest couple in the room. I mean, they just glowed the entire time. And they just came up and said, we just got to thank you. And when we finally understood and got God-centered, it was amazing. The relation, the same person that drove me to want to, you know, murder the person before, now just brings me delight every day. Just simply a change in focus. And that's really was the problem with this guy, wasn't it? I mean, he'd been forgiven a fortune, and yet can you still be a self-centered person after God has given you so much? Well, you can't if your focus is in the wrong place. Well, what about with your kids? You know, could you be a graceless father? And you know, the problem, I'll tell you, by the way, is I find a lot of Christian parents who are extremely conscientious about being a parent. You know, Christians are oftentimes to a higher degree than a non-Christian because they also are concerned not about their kid just getting married and going to college, but they want their kid to turn out well and to honor God and not be immoral and so on. And so these parents have all this burden to make sure they turn out good kids. And so, you know, you surround your kids with rules. And in fact, my daughter and I just wrote a book together called Customized Parenting, which is all about pushing back on a lot of that kind of thinking. But we surround our kids with rules and curfews because we want our kids to turn out good. And you know, probably the most common thing that people tell me when they walked away from the faith of their parents, which by the way is about 70% to 80% of kids growing up in church are walking away from the church today. The number one reason is, it was no fun growing up in my home. All it was rules. I could never please my dad. My dad had such high standards. No matter what I did, he was always pushing me. And a lot of times they do it with the best of intentions. I just want the best for my kid. But what they don't realize is there's no grace there. There's no grace. They've just become these legalistic tyrants that their kids can never please. Well, I remember one day, the church I was in. I was the president of a seminary at the time, and I've got three teenage kids, and our church is going to have a pictorial directory made. And I had this idea, because I thought, you know, if they're going to take a picture of my family, well, you know, I every Christmas I get these postcards from other school presidents, and it's a picture of their family, maybe in front of a Christmas tree or in front of the school, and it's, you know, holiday wishes from my family to yours, and so on. And it's like to raise money and, you know, send it to their donors and their alumni. And so I thought, hey, you know, I've never done that. I should do that. We're going to take a picture of my family anyway. I'll just take that picture. I'll make postcards. I'll send it out to all of our donors and supporters of the school. You know, we try to raise some money. And the problem is I didn't tell my family my plan. And so on the day of the pictures, we're going to get a picture at 4:30, and it's 4 o'clock. I come out into the little entranceway of our house. I'm bellowing up, "All right, everybody, come on, we got to go. We got a picture in 30 minutes. We got to get to the church. Come on, hurry." And in a moment, my wife comes out. She looks beautiful. I'm thinking, this is going to be great. I just love it when my plans come together. And, you know, it's all coming together. And then my teenage daughter comes out next. She looks beautiful. Of course she should. She's been in the bathroom for 4 hours, but she looks great. I think we're gonna raise millions with this. And so then my younger teenage son Daniel comes out, and he's got, I don't know what you'd call it here. If you've been in Canada, you know you would call it a toque, but it's called different things in the States. But it's a knitted cap, woolen cap. He's got it pulled down right over his head. My son looks like he's about to go out and rob a bank, and so it's like, okay, now that's not going to happen. That will not be in the picture. But we'll, you know, I'm trying to stay calm here, like, you know, I'm a Christian, and but I'm looking at my wife like, can you deal with that? Like that can't be in the picture. And so then he actually wore, he's also wearing this heavy metal sweatshirt with the logo on it, and you know, so this, I've got a couple issues with him. But my oldest son is this. He's a very good looking boy. Could have been a model, I suppose, a teenager. And I'm thinking, okay, this is perfect. My oldest son is a heartthrob. All the girls love him. You know, get him up front and center. It's going to just cap off that picture. But I don't know what happened to my son that day. Like, I don't know if he slipped and fell on the hardwood floor in his bedroom, struck his head against a hard, blunt object or something. But for some reason, on that particular day, that son decides, wouldn't it be cool if I spiked all of my hair so it looks like a porcupine, and then I dyed all the tips a fluorescent glow-in-the-dark blue. And so my son comes out, all these little spikes, and they're all all the tips are blue. And he comes out and says, "Hi, Dad, I'm your son, and I've got blue hair." And I'm in shock. I said, both of those facts deeply disturb me right now. The fact you're my son and that you have blue hair. And all kinds of awful comments are coming to mind. I can't decide whether to insult him alphabetically or insult him just as they come to mind. And my wife, sensing a very unpleasant moment's about to happen, she grabs me and says, "Richard, come on, we need to talk for a moment." I'm saying, "But what about that?" She says, "No, we need to talk right now." And she pulls me around the room, and she said, "Before you say anything, I just want to remind you of a couple of things." She said, "For one, our son is I think he was 18 then. She said he has never used drugs." I said, "Are you telling me he's not on drugs right now? What sane, uninebriated person would do that to themselves?" She said, "He's never smoked a cigarette. I mean, we've never heard him use a word of profanity. We have no record of him ever using a word of profanity. He's playing on 4 different worship bands right now. On an elite traveling worship band at his school, on the church band, a community worship team, the church one, the youth one." She said, he's in Bible college this year, thinking about going into the ministry. And she said one other thing, and this is the thing that nailed me. She said, "That I happen to know that the hair dye that he used today, it won't last 2.5 weeks. She said, "Don't say something today that wounds your son the rest of his life about something that won't last 2.5 weeks. And I was about to. And I was reminded in that moment, I remember meeting him as an African-American businessman, real together guy. Met him, he was 65 years old. Been very successful in business, very accomplished person. But he began to tell me a story about when he was 15. He's thinking back 50 years in his life. And his dad had bought his first Cadillac. And his dad was so thrilled with that car. He had it in a little garage in the back of their property. And three of his buddies had come by to see the new car. And so this very proud man told his 15-year-old son, "Son, pull the car out so I can show it to my friends." But the son didn't see that a wheelbarrow had been leaned up against the wall of the garage. And as he pulls out that big car, it scrapes against that wheelbarrow all the way down the side of the car. When that man comes around to show his three friends the car, the first thing he sees is this scratch down the side of his new car. The dad was a deacon in his church. He was called on to pray the offertory prayer almost every service. And that 15-year-old boy, in the next few moments, was cursed out in a way he didn't know his dad even knew how. And he said, in the next few moments, "I knew what my dad had always thought of me and my possibilities in my future." This guy starts tearing up. Now, that's 50 years earlier. He's remembering what his dad said. He said, "You know, my dad eventually traded that car in. Got something else." He said, "That car was used to make cans of green beans." He said, "It was something used for something else. It wasn't even a car anymore." But he never forgot what his dad thought of him. And my wife was saying, "Richard, you're about to do that with our son over something that won't last 2.5 weeks. Is it really that important?" You know what I realized? The whole deal was, does it matter, I suppose, how you shape your hair? But it was about me. It was about, what are people going to say when they see the seminary president's son walking around with blue hair, spiked up like it is? And I had people come to me and say, "Hey, I saw your son's hair. How are you raising those kids over there in your house?" And I thought, that's why I'm mad. It's because of me. It's, what are people going to think about me? Not about what's my son going to be thinking, how is he going to feel. You know, in fact, when the book on grace first came out, I tell that story in there. It had a paper dust cover originally, and on the back I used that picture on the grace book. And now the publisher actually whited out the band logo on my younger son's t-shirt, but the hair is all there, all spiked out, so everybody could see. You know, that son today is a single adult minister working on a PhD in apologetics. And in fact, these last two Sundays, tomorrow morning, church of 8,000 members, my brother's the senior pastor who hired him. He's going to have my son, he preached last Sunday, he's going to preach this Sunday. He wants him to preach a series because next to my brother, the senior pastor, my son is the most popular preacher in that church. And his hair is its normal color now, but it's still spiked quite a bit. In fact, his name's Mike. All the senior adults have dubbed him Spiky Mike. They all love him. He says all the senior adults just love Spiky Mike. In fact, now we've joined that church. Now we moved to Atlanta. Everybody comes up and says, "Oh yeah, you're Spiky Mike's dad, aren't you?" I thought to myself, you know, so many of the things I said that I regretted, I said them about things that didn't even, 2 weeks later, wasn't even an issue anymore. But the people still remembered them. Ephesians 4:29 says, "Don't ever let an unwholesome word come out of your mouth. Don't let a garbage word, don't let a sewage word," it says, "come out of your mouth. But let every word be one that builds up and brings grace, gives grace to the hearers." With your mouth, you have the ability to actually dispense grace to people if you would so choose to. But my problem is, and I think the problem with a lot of men is, we forget what matters and we get all uptight about stuff that doesn't matter. If we think in terms of what can I say to my son that will make him more like Christ, that will make him love the church, love his family more, then certain words come out of my mouth. If I'm thinking about me and how it's embarrassed me, what will people say about me? Will they think about me less? I've got other words that come out of my mouth. I remember at one point, when about the same time that that happened, we had built the only time I ever had a house built. I built a house. It was a new subdivision. I've got all these teenage kids. I thought this is the time to get a house big enough to accommodate all the kids. But so it's the most expensive house I'd ever had, and the largest mortgage I'd ever had. So I'm kind of stressed about this. Never paid this much for a house. Can I afford it? What if I can't, you know, afford this? If things get tough, and what if I have to sell it again? But I'd never had a, you know, if you ever had a brand new house, like I'd never had a house where there's not a scratch anywhere, there's not a mark anywhere. The walls are perfect. The hardwood floor is perfect. Everything's perfect. And I thought, I've never been in a perfect house before. This is amazing, but I've got three teenage kids. How long is this house going to remain perfect? So I read the Riot Act. All right, guys, like, there's no throwing stuff, no roughhousing, you know, all the rules that could damage the house. I'm sitting one day in this beautiful living room that we now have and having coffee with my wife, and all of a sudden I hear this loud bang on the house. I thought a small airplane had crashed into the upstairs. I go bursting out the front door, like, what on earth has happened to my house? And I see my two sons, they're playing street hockey. And they put a goal right in front of the garage. And my son Mike has taken a mighty slap shot with the hockey ball. It's missed the goal. He missed the net. Has struck the garage door and left this hideous, huge, marring gash just right there in that garage door. I mean, it's massive. Like, you could, I'm sure the Hubble telescope could zero in and say, what is the disturbance in the force over here on this guy's garage door? I can't believe it. My children are shooting projectiles toward my very expensive, unpaid for house. I couldn't believe it. I read in the Riot Act. I gave them a moving speech about depreciating real estate values and resale value and good stewardship. I mean, I pulled out the works, and I also told them what I would do to them with their own hockey sticks if they ever shot another ball at the direction of our house. I said, aim the net at the neighbor's house. Go out into the garage. Go and play in the street. Play in the freeway for all I care. But don't shoot things at the house. And they swore to me that it was highly unusual that they would ever miss a shot like that. That would never happen again. I said, well, believe me, it will never happen again. And I went back. I'm in a sweat. I'm in a lather. And I'm sitting down. And I literally, before I can take another drink of coffee, I hear bang. Number two. My feet are spinning. I'm going out so fast to wring their little scrawny necks. They're running. I mean, they're already like halfway down the street. He's coming. And I'm shouting, you can run, but you can't hide. I know where you live. I'll be waiting for you. I don't care how long it takes. And they're just gone. They're running for their lives. I came back in. Now there's two hideous scars there in my house. I went in, I sat down, And now I'm just, and my coffee's cold, and I'm just so upset. Like, when those boys come back, what am I going to do? And my wife looks at me and she says, well, I guess we've got to decide if we're going to live in a home or a museum. And I just hate that when my wife does that to me. She said, we've got two teenage boys who like being at our house. Like, all their friends want to be at our house. It's known as the funnest place in the entire youth group is our home. And wouldn't it be a shame if now nobody could have fun here anymore because you're afraid of resale value one day? And I had to do a lot of soul searching because, you know, there's a lot of issues involved there. But at the end of the day, God just said, you know what? You could replace that garage door one day. For the couple $100 it will cost you, your kids could have hours and hours of a lot of fun at their house. I decided, you know what? Kids are important than garage doors. And so I actually went out. When they finally came back, I got my hockey stick and went out there and started playing. There were like 10,000 marks on that garage door. Eventually, in fact, people, when they were trying to find our house, when there were parties at our house all the time, people said, we're just going to this neighbor. Look for the house that looks like someone unloaded a machine gun on their garage door. That's the Blackaby's house. That's how you can tell. It's like totally disfigured. But, you know, and so we had so many things going down in that house. We had a basketball net. We had all kinds of stuff. Got a pool table in the basement. It was just like a fun, fun place. It was where every party was, where anything going down with the youth group, that's where it happened. And then a couple years later, it was in the summertime, my kids had all gone off to camp. And I had been on a trip somewhere, and when I got home, my wife, all my kids are at camp, so I know I'm coming home to an empty house. But normally, when I'd come home at the end of the day, the day's work, whenever I turned this one corner in our street, the first time I could see our house, there would always be, I'd always look to see, okay, what kids are at our house today? Is it a basketball game going down? Is there a hockey game going down? And many times I'd pull up, and they'd be out, you know, maybe inline skating, hockey game, they'd in the street. They'd be, Dad, hurry, get your skates on. Come on, we've got a game going. Or come on, shoot some hoops. And I got to the point where every day I came home from work, I was just like, okay, what's the game going to be today? What are we doing today? And so I pull around the corner, and I know in my mind that there's no, you know, they're not at home. But I pull around the corner, and the driveway is empty. There's nobody there. Nothing going on. I go to pull into that garage, and I see that marred garage door, and it was like God just said, you know, one day, not too far in the future, you're going to come home, and nobody will be in the driveway anymore. There'll be no more games going down, and the only thing you'll have left will be the scars here and there in the house that remind you, this was a house that was well lived in. This was a house that had a lot of parties, a lot of good times, a lot of good memories. You know, I remember as I drove in, I thought to myself, you know what, even when these kids aren't playing in the driveway anymore, I'm not sure I'm going to replace that garage door. Because I think that becomes a trophy to me. That cries out to the whole community, this is a house where people had a good time. They didn't do drugs, they weren't doing crime, they just had fun. Just godly Christian fun. This was a happy place to be. And you know, grace helps you to see what matters. And it helps you let go of stuff that doesn't really matter. And there's just a ton of stuff that doesn't really matter. And most of the little tantrums I've had with my kids over the years have been about stuff that you look back later and you say, what was the big deal? I just wish I hadn't said those hurtful, unkind things that I can never pull back out and put back in my mouth. They're gone. They've done their damage. They'll be remembered the rest of their life. One last thing just to say, and you know, really, the world is filled, you know, the difference, by the way, between, say, Islam and other religions and Christianity, in large part, is grace. Nobody teaches grace like Christianity. The God of the Christians is the only God that says, just keep forgiving. They persecute you, they slap you on the cheek, they offend you, you just keep loving in return. Even other religions don't teach that. Christianity is unique. People don't get grace. When you show them grace, they don't get it. I remember I was flying to New Mexico. I was going to speak at a conference center outside of Santa Fe, and I landed at the Santa Fe airport. I think it was Santa Fe airport in New Mexico, and I was going to have to drive an hour out to the conference center, and the guy who picked me up said, Richard, you know, once we get out there, we won't have dinner for a while, but he said, there's a great Mexican restaurant right here in the airport. Do you want to just grab something to eat before I drive you out there? I said, yeah, love Mexican, that'd be good. He said, it's a pretty good place. So I've got my suitcase and my computer bag. I just pull it into the restaurant, set it down, and I ordered the enchilada platter. I was hungry. I hadn't been fed. I hadn't been upgraded on that flight, so I'm hungry. And so it's an older woman. I mean, she's got to be, I mean, probably at least well into her 60s, and to be waiting tables like that in a very busy airport restaurant is, you know, probably pushing it for her. But she comes out at a certain point, and she doesn't speak English very well, and she puts down the platter for my friend. She goes to put down the platter for me, and her wrist buckles, and this whole big platter of enchiladas falls and shatters on the table right in front of me. I mean, just sprays me. And I've only got two pairs of pants. I'm going to be speaking all week at this place. I've only got two pairs of dress pants. And this tomato sauce completely just decimates the pair of pants I'm wearing. I mean, I've got rice and refried beans sliding into the cuffs of my pants. And it's just splattered everywhere. And of course, it's one of those loud crashes, you know, and it just splatters everywhere. And everybody looks. And this woman gets down, and she's starting to scurry about, and it exploded. It's stuff everywhere. And I'm just annoyed. I've been flying all morning. I'm tired. I've gotten splattered with my lunch. And I'm just, you know, you're just kind of getting irritated, like this carelessness, sloppiness. Now look at me. Like, what am I going to wear this week? I was planning on wearing these pants for at least two of my presentations. I'm down to one pair. It doesn't even match all the shirts I've got. When am I going to, you know, it's all about me, how this is inconvenience me. It's carelessness. And I remember looking down, and then I never forget, like this woman, she's humiliated, she's trying to pull everything up on the floor, and a young teenage waitress from another section, she comes up. Now, never forget, this teenager had this disgusted look on her face, like this wasn't the first time this had happened. And she's got this big towel, and she throws it at this woman, and says, "Well, clean it up!" And then she goes off to wait her own tables. And in that moment, it was like the Spirit of God, like the heart of Christ, just spoke to me. He said, "Look at this woman." And I look at her, and this woman obviously has had a hard life, obviously working hard. And it was like God said, "Why do you think at her age she's having to do a job that's beyond her, working with a lot of young kids that disrespect her? What do you think she's facing at home? What debts, what expenses, what obligations, what hurts has forced her into a job that's beyond what she's capable of doing?" And I'm sitting there wondering that, just looking at her, and I just felt like God, in a very practical way, said, "And what are you doing sitting there and not helping?" And so I got down, I grabbed all the napkins on the table, I started to help clean it up and scrape it up. I'm in my good clothes, and she looked, they're ruined anyway, and she looked at me, and right away she said, "Oh, no, I will do that." And I said, "It's all right." I said, "I've got three kids, I'm used to this." And I started cleaning it up. And I'll never forget the look in her face. It was like, I don't know the last time she'd had a kind thing done or said to her. Like, she certainly wasn't expecting it from me. And it was just that moment of grace. You know. And she brought me eventually another platter. And then it gets time to leave a tip. what do you do? You know, like, how do you tip someone that's just cost you about $20 worth of dry cleaning? And I just thought Jesus just said, "Show grace." Grace isn't—it's not based on what someone deserved. It's on looking like Jesus. Which, by the way, I've talked to a lot of waiters and waitresses who say they dread church groups coming in because oftentimes they're the stingiest, cheapest people that come into their table that they get. Maybe leave them a scripture instead of a tip. And I just felt like saying, "God, let me represent your heart to this woman right now." And so we were far more generous than she deserved with that kind of service. You know, a funny thing was, the tomato sauce had sprayed all over my suitcase and had gone into the zippers. And so I've got tomato sauce sinking into the zipper. You can't clean that out. Like, it's stuck in there on my computer bag. And it was funny because, well, I had a dog named Chevy at the time. And for the next probably six trips that I went on, I'd pull my luggage to the, you know, the garage door, getting ready to head out the door. I'd find my dog just licking my suitcase. Apparently he liked Mexican food, too. But, you know, I thought to myself, our world is filled with people who never experienced grace. All they've ever heard are the words of condemnation. They've just been put down. They've been given what they deserved. They've never had anybody give them what they didn't deserve, who just forgave them when they fully deserved just to be reamed out, who gave them a tip when they knew full well they didn't deserve any tip, when they were spoken to kindly, when they know that they had not really measured up. People aren't used to that. And so what an amazing way to reflect the heart of Christ. Every time you go to work, every time you go to a restaurant, every time you get served to represent Jesus, grace is giving what isn't deserved. My question to you is, to the people that live in your home, the people that work next to you, people that serve you throughout the week, would they describe you as a person of grace? I've had people say, you know, "My dad was a man of faith. My dad was a man of evangelism. My dad was a leader in the church." But oftentimes you don't hear kids describing their dad as a dad of grace. "He was a man of grace. Well, I messed up so many times. My dad always believed in me. My dad always spoke words of kindness, even when I deserved probably to have been just yelled at. Well, I tell you what, if there was one guy I knew that would be like Jesus to me, it was my dad." That's being a person of grace. The reason we're not always people of grace is we've forgotten the day that the King of Kings said, your debt is forgiven. Don't ever lose the wonder of that day, because it makes you stop acting like the King himself when you start relating to others. Well, let me pray with you, and I'll be done. Lord, thank you. I suppose one of the reasons that heaven will be for an eternity is because it will take us that long to thank you for all that you have done for us. And Lord, I pray we never lose the wonder of that moment when you forgave us of everything we'd ever done. And Lord, you forgot it. It was as if it never existed. And Lord, I pray that we could somehow reflect you in the way we relate to others. God, may our homes be homes of grace. May they just be an oasis. May they be a safe place for people that have been chewed up by this world and hurt by the words and the barbs and the insults that is so permeating the world in which we live. Lord, may people make their way to our home and know that that's a place where they receive words that build them up, words that shower them with grace. God, if we're just passing by, just getting gas, just getting a delivery, just doing business with a customer, God, every chance we have to open our mouth and dispense grace, may we use that moment for your glory. Lord, may we just shower people with grace. May our children be blessed with grace. May our wives, Lord, just know what it's like to receive grace daily when they know full well they may not deserve it. But God, may we just be people that just can't help but give grace because of what we've received ourselves. So help us, God, if we need to make some adjustments in the area of the grace in which we dispense. May we not be paradoxical Christians who greedily receive your grace but then stingily give it to others. Help us to be strong in grace. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.